So, hello everyone. Thanks for coming to lecture two in this series on amanuenses in early modern Europe. So on Tuesday, I emphasized the longue durée of the practice of relying on amanuenses for many kinds of textual help, most iconically for taking dictation. The term existed in antiquity, but entered common usage in the Renaissance, first in Latin, then in English and German. In French and Italian, the closest equivalent is secretary, but I explained that I won't be using the term that much because I'm not addressing the political and diplomatic contexts in which it's most commonly used. So I prefer amanuensis, but I will use secretary from time to time. I also introduced the term principal, borrowing from current corporate lingo in the US, may it be useful for something, to designate the person employing the amanuensis. Typically, amanuenses were young men, recent university graduates, paid in room and board and occasional gifts. And I'm also including in my category members of the scholar's household who served as amanuenses while they were students or family members. Today, and in the following lectures, I'll shift my focus to the early modern period, especially the early modern period, roughly the 16th century down to 1650 or so, to ponder what was distinctive about it for the history of amanuenses. And today I'd like to make three points. There were more amanuenses and more settings for scholarship in early modern period than previous ones. And despite many forces favoring their invisibility, amanuenses become more visible then too, facilitating their study. So my first point is that amanuenses are a kind of servant, as is clear from some of the terms by which they're also called, famulus, minister, domesticus, and vernacular forms of those terms, including expressions like amen in my service. So it's helpful to consult the literature on servants about broad trends, even though hand servants or amanuenses are barely mentioned there as a specific category. Any early modern household that could afford their upkeep would employ servants, given the many onerous tasks to be performed both indoors and outdoors. The 16th century was generally a period of growth in population, in prosperity, also in inequality, and also in the presence of servants. In one well-documented English parish, Romford, located in what is now Greater London, and which was then a diversified agricultural area, in 1562, 83% of the households with three or more people included a servant, which the mean number of servants was 2.3, ranging from one in the smaller homes to seven in the largest. Servants comprised 20% of the total population in Romford in that year, roughly equally distributed between young men and young women, and they would enter service between the ages of 10 and 20, and they left when they married and established their own household, typically in their mid-20s. This is life cycle service. A broader study estimates that 40% of all children became servants as adolescents in the 16th century. This pattern of placing adolescents in other families was common across Northwestern Europe, though interestingly I learned that not in Italy, where it was regarded as a dereliction of child-rearing, putting up with your own teenagers, rather than someone else's. During these years, young people left home, gained experience and skills, and formed lasting social bonds. Many married within their cohort of servants in the area, and years later, their wills included bequests to former fellow servants and former employers. When it's possible to trace the activities of the former servants, we can measure the impact of the skills they acquired. Almost half of the men entered the same line of work as the head of the household in which they had served. The servant can be hard to distinguish from others in similar positions of dependency, such as apprentices contracted to learn a trade while living and serving in the master's home, relatives placed in service within their extended family, and in the case of academic families, students who boarded with their teacher. The children in a household would also be positioned on this spectrum during the relevant phase of life. They too were expected to help with household tasks, to learn alongside students who boarded. And even adult family members could be treated like servants when they remained dependents in the household for reasons of ill health, disability, or lack of marriage prospects. Wives were considered dependents too in early modern European households, but unlike children and servants, they played a role in controlling property. Women could sue their husbands for squandering their dowry, for example, and they held special authority within the household, in particular in supervising and training servants and children. On the one hand, a shared relationship of dependency on the pater familias could erode differences of status among the various kinds of dependents. Everyone owed the pater familias loyalty, obedience in their demeanor, and diligence, honesty, and discretion in their work. On the other hand, the experience of dependency was contingent on many variables, including positive and negative emotional interactions and social standing. so student boarders of a higher standing than the teacher warranted special deference. And adolescents of high standing sent to other great houses hoped to receive more personal attention than regular servants. For example, one well-born young man, Robert Plompton, anticipating the completion of his legal studies at the Inner Temple, requested help from his mother in 1536 to become a household servant of Sir William Gascoigne of Gawthorpe, requesting specifically not to be only his servant, but of his household and attending unto him, for else he would do as other lords do, knows not half their servants. Given his level of education, this young graduate likely aspired to be something like an amanuensis or a valet, as he put it, not only a servant, but attending unto him. That proximity to the paterfamilias was a crucial mark of prestige throughout the household. And this criterion elevated wives to the foremost position among the dependents, then positioned those with most direct access to him over all others, the children he favored due to their abilities, their age, their sex, and those well-born adolescents placed in the household to gain training for adulthood. By the same logic, then, the amanuensis held a choice position among the servants, given his regular and direct access to the principal. Furthermore, the social status of the principal beyond the household redounded on all the members inside it, hence the appeal to servants of upholding and even exaggerating their principal's status in order to improve their own by the same token. The historiography on servants in the early modern period has documented a shift between the 16th and 18th centuries, resulting in the formation of increasingly rigid social hierarchies over time, including the stiffening of boundaries between journeymen and masters in trades governed by guilds, for example. The practice of placing well-born youth in other households ceased in England after the Civil War in the mid-17th century. In the 18th century, then, service was more often a lifelong occupation entered into by young people from lower and lower middle social orders. They were less likely to move up and out of their status. Servants were also ranked in more elaborate hierarchies within the household, upper and lower, liveried and not, with a pay scale corresponding to status, and with the possibility of promotion within and between households. Given the level of education generally expected of amanuenses, they may have been somewhat shielded from this trend towards social stratification. But even in the 16th century, there's evidence of status anxiety, as Arnold Hunt calls it, around the position of secretary, driven in part by the sense that more and more young men had just enough education to try to claim the title and the role. I don't think we can even try to measure the numerical growth of secretaries or scholarly amanuenses, but it's reasonable to assume that they became more numerous, along with a general increase in the number of servants, which had to do with increasing wealth. I'll emphasize in any case that the experience of the amanuensis was highly variable and dependent on each specific context. This was true for all servants, of course, but especially so for amanuenses, whose activity centered around a personal relationship with the principal, a relationship both intimate and hierarchical. So now, the general invisibility of amanuenses. Even though they worked for people, scholars, who wrote abundantly in manuscript and in print, scholarly amanuenses are generally hard to see. Servants in general were expected to work behind the scenes and were ignored as individuals in both early modern and modern periods. I mentioned last time that Goethe called his servants Karl, regardless of their real names, in the early 1800s. In the late 1500s, Montaigne observed, "I have to call the servants who work for me by the name of their function or the region they come from, because it's very hard for me to remember their names." This passage is part of a rumination on memory more generally, and Montaigne's point was that he had a bad memory for names, but the example he offers suggests that knowing his servants' names was not a high priority for him, even while he remembered where they were from and what they did around the house. Saramazza has argued that the servant was expected to work very hard and be completely loyal to their employer for ethical reasons, because it was their role, rather than to fulfill part in a monetary transaction. She offers examples where a servant's reputation was ruthlessly sacrificed to protect that of the master. For example, in a case where an innkeeper had cheated customers by diluting their wine, the servant girl was blamed so the master could be deemed innocent. Even when the parties to the legal case were aware that an innocent servant had been wrongly accused, no concern for the servant or redress of their reputation was mentioned in the documents. These connotations of diligence, loyalty, and sacrifice are all present in the 20th century term and concept of the domestique in road bicycle racing, an expert rider who works solely for the benefit of their team and team leader without seeking to gain standing for themselves, although some domestiques have later become champions on their own account. The sociologist Irving Goffman offered the servant as the classic example of the non-person, which he defines as someone present during an interaction, but who is neither performer nor audience, so that the interaction proceeds in their presence as if they were not present. Stephen Chapin coined the term invisible technicians after observing that accounts of experiments performed at the Royal Society and elsewhere in the late 17th century focused on the new instruments involved, air pumps, for example, and various principals who devised and witnessed the experiment, Royal Society members or their guests in particular. The verbal and iconographic depictions, though, left out those crucial to the performance of the experiments, the servants who manipulated the instruments, drawing on special skills, experience, physical strength, for example, for pumping out the air in the chamber of the instrument. Robert Boyle, one of Chapin's main examples, relied on multiple assistants in his laboratory, 2 to 6 of them at a time. But Boyle's published accounts of work in his laboratory generally omitted mention of assistants by using passives or an undefined first-person plural, as in we pumped, or the pump being set to work. Or occasionally he mentions one of them as he that managed the pump. In a similar vein, the iconography of experiments in printed books in the 17th and 18th centuries often depicted putti, or disembodied hands holding or turning instruments, or sometimes people with no faces. In these cases, a principal composed an account of the experiment that omitted or effaced the presence and contribution of the assistant, in keeping with this idea that servants are non-persons. But the principals were not the only ones effacing their helpers. In some cases, amanuenses effaced themselves. The Vettori family offers a prime example of this pattern, made visible by the work of Raphael Mouren and other experts on Vettori. So Piero Vettori was a major Florentine humanist responsible for editions of Sallust, Varro, Cato, Aeschylus, Euripides, and Aristotle, among others. Vettori's papers survive thanks to the role that his descendants had in preserving them, notably his son Jacopo and grandson Francesco Vettori. There is a Francesco Vettori whose portrait is available, but that's the father of Piero. These two don't seem to warrant a portrait, and you can infer from that their standing relative to the people we do have portraits for. So both Jacopo and Francesco, son and grandson, received a strong humanist education and were involved, along with students of Piero Vettori, in preparing the editions that he published. In particular, several manuscripts among Piero's papers were written in the hand of Jacopo, as scholars have identified by the handwriting. At Piero's death in 1585, one of his former students, Leonardo Salviati, delivered and then published a funeral oration, for which he got information about Piero's life from a swiftly composed biography left in manuscript by Piero's grandson, Francesco. Among the many compliments that Francesco paid his grandfather in this manuscript, Instruzione al Signor Salviati, he praised the famous humanist for working alone. His efforts in his studies were very great, because up to 2 years ago, when he was 85 years old, he got up many hours before the day, and everything he wrote was always collected with his own effort. And as someone who is most precise in things, he never found anyone as diligent as he was. He never asked for help from anyone. And when he wanted to find a thing, he rather deprived himself of an hour of sleep and did it by himself, having been, as was written, of Varro, a polygraph. It's a marvel that he never had help from anyone, something that has not been the case in other great men of letters, for they had, as is known, many to help them seek, while they themselves made no other efforts than to arrange things, and we see many instances of this. Only to copy things before they were published, he sometimes kept a scribe, and this was necessary for him because his hand trembled and his handwriting was not understood except with difficulty. This indisposition gave him an impediment, but it was not noticeable, nor did he feel it, except for this and for drinking, in that he had to hold the glass with both hands. So here we have someone speaking with the authority of an intimate, the grandson, denying precisely the role that he and his father had both played in working with Piero. The one who knows firsthand about Piero's method of working prefers to claim that Piero never had help from anyone. This is not surprising, given the ethos of protecting and advancing the reputation of the paterfamilias in a learned family, which applied to all his dependents, whether family members or servants. The purpose of a funeral oration, for which this biography was composed, only further prioritized this goal. So Francesco's calculus presumably is better to be the grandson of the best possible humanist than to be a bit player in a humanist of lesser merit. But why should relying on the help of others reduce Piero Vettori's status? Francesco's self-effacement is evidence of ambivalence in this milieu toward a scholar having help from others. On Francesco's account, Vettori is admirable because he did everything himself, even at the cost of his sleep, whereas other humanists ask assistants to gather and copy things and just have the effort of arranging them. This anti-amanuensis sentiment is not often articulated as explicitly as in this case. After all, articulating it involves putting everyone else down who did rely on helpers. And of course, it's also quite untrue, as in this one, as Francesco and other former students of Vettori well knew. We have, for example, a letter by one of these students, Girolamo May, reminiscing with another student, Bartolomeo Barbadori, about their work together preparing editions which Vittori published, of Aeschylus, Euripides, and Apollonius of Rhodes in particular. Piero Vittori himself even thanked students in print for their great help in, quote, finding things he was looking for. So, interestingly, the actual funeral oration that Salviati delivered and published did not pick up the no amanuensis theme from Francesco's manuscript, Instruzione. Also worth noting that some kind of help, even while a picture of someone who required none, Francesco identified a kind of help that did not mar that image. After a work was finished, Piero would hire a scribe to copy things before they were published. I interpret this as making a fair copy for the printer, and this is a virtuous act, an additional expense made for the purpose of minimizing errors at the print shop and eliciting the best quality production, which was clearly a high priority for a humanist. But to reduce the stigma of even this virtuous reliance on a scribe to make a clean copy, Francesco also adduced the physical handicap. Piero suffered from a tremor, which made his handwriting difficult to read and required him to hold a glass with both hands. In sum, Piero was a great humanist because he didn't have amanuenses, and when he did rely on one, it was only to make a final copy for the printer, and even then he only did so because of a tremor in his hands. So we have two rounds of extenuating circumstances designed to ensure that the use of a scribe would not detract from the admiration due to Vittori, the great humanist who worked alone. In a similar example brought to my attention by Margaret Meserve, Pope Pius II entrusted the manuscript of his commentaries, a kind of memoir, to the humanist Gian Antonio Campano, so he could correct them. The manuscript, which survives in the Vatican Library, shows a mix of hands, including autographed parts by Pius, overlaid with corrections by Campano, including five elegant poems that Campano had composed and inserted, evidently with Pius's approval. Nevertheless, when Campano wrote to a cardinal, probably not long after Pius's death in 1464, he explained, "Pius gave the commentaries to me corrected. I did not correct them. Who would amend something which, so far from needing to be improved, would only provoke someone audacious to imitate the greatest eloquence? That prospect should deter the wise man." So Campano used the authority of his position as a first-hand observer to efface his own work of correcting and even inserting bits of his own composition into the work published under the name of the Pope. Instead, he extolled the Pope's natural eloquence and claimed that it alone had brought the work to its final form. So the notion exemplified in these cases that a scholar is all the greater for working alone complicates the interpretation of claims made at the time and since that a given scholar never relied on amanuenses. Certainly, some scholars did work alone, especially at some points in their life and on certain projects, but statements to that effect, including the scholar's own, warrant being treated with caution, given the appeal of making such claims, whether about oneself or someone one wished to portray as admirable. And I've found people, for example, of Claude Sommet's Hartlib saying he did all his correspondence alone, and on the other hand, Daniel Morhoff giving him as an example that of someone who hired a scholar to take notes for him in using his own judgment. So we have contradictory evidence about one great man. Clearly it can be spun to support the position that you're trying to push. Self-effacement is not specific to the religious or hierarchical values of the early modern period. In Multiple Authorship and the Myth of the Solitary Genius, Jack Stillinger highlights the impact of editors on many modern English language authors, from Pound's heavy editing of T.S. Eliot to the experience of American novelists like Fitzgerald, Hemingway, or Thomas Wolfe, who all worked with Maxwell Perkins of Charles Scribner's Sons. Perkins prompted major revisions which were likely crucial to the success of the novels involved, including, for example, the characterization of the eponymous hero of The Great Gatsby. But Perkins consistently downplayed his contributions and instructed aspiring editors to do the same. Indeed, self-effacement is crucial to successful employment in this line of work. Sillinger notes that authors often thank editors in their acknowledgments, but would likely shun an editor who really sought credit for his or her contributions. As a result, Stillinger concludes, it would appear that the myth of the author's preeminence is strongly cherished by the very people who have the greatest knowledge of the author's failings and needs for assistance. Like modern editors, early modern amanuenses, despite knowing best how much they'd contributed, typically did not draw attention to that work. A further factor that likely contributed to obscuring the work of amanuenses in general, though perhaps not in the Vittori case, was a reluctance of the former amanuensis to draw attention to their humble beginnings once they had achieved some standing. Francesco Vittori might have felt that his own status as a respected humanist, recently acquired given his youth, would not be enhanced by reminiscing about his period of dependency to another scholar, even his grandfather. But, of course, humanist family pedigree was spun favorably, but still humble beginnings were more generally an occasion for mockery by one's enemies than a point of pride. So Thomas Wolsey was mocked for being the son of a butcher throughout his rise through successful secretarial positions to the level of Lord Chancellor. and Petrus Ramus in France, as I'll discuss later, for his peasant origins. So I wonder about the several authors and scholars, major figures in early modern England, such as John Donne, Edmund Spenser, Thomas Hobbes, and John Locke, whom we know to have served as secretaries, to what extent they discussed in print or in public that aspect of their experience. The French poet Joachim du Bellay, who served as in the entourage of the more prestigious relative, the Cardinal Jean du Bellay in Rome, made allusions to his time in this service, which have come to light through the attentive analysis of Olivier Millet. On Millet's reading of two passages in du Bellay's Regrets, the poet discreetly indicated unhappiness about his status due to disappointing financial rewards and limited access to Jean, despite his family connection. But it isn't anything explicit, of course. So in sum, there are multiple forces that tended to hide the presence and contributions of amanuenses. The general assumption that servants could be treated as non-persons, that a scholar working alone was more praiseworthy than one who relied on helpers, and the awareness on the part of helpers themselves that self-effacement in favor of aggrandizing the principal was more beneficial than seeking a share of the credit. So when I started this project, I titled it Hidden Helpers. But I find myself moving away from that title now, and I've called it In the Scholar's Workshop, because after looking for amanuenses for a good while, I've found them much more often than I expected to. Although amanuenses generally remain in the shadow, they are more visible in the early modern period than in previous ones. And here I'd like to shift to that third point today, to talk about reasons for the greater visibility of amanuenses in the Renaissance. So at first, a very basic material factor is the increased survival of personal papers, which enables the historian to see hands of amanuenses intermingled or not with those of the principal in these collections of manuscripts. And paper here was the crucial ingredient. The combination of durability and cheapness, at least relative to parchment, made it easy to accumulate working papers and notes, which once would have been taken on temporary surfaces like wax tablets. Paper had been available north of the Alps since the early 14th century, but the spread of printing after the 15th century prompted paper mills to proliferate to supply the presses, so the paper became more abundant and less expensive, also for the purposes of handwriting. And once the notes were saved on paper, the scholars themselves, their students, family members, could appreciate their value and in some cases ensured their survival. And I'll talk about the topic of personal archives in Lecture 5. Secondly, another kind of source that survives in abundance is correspondence. Letters, for which the early modern Republic of Letters is named, include plenty of private discussion of amanuenses as principals sought to hire them, complained about them, recommended them to others, and casually referred to their presence in scribing and helping to deliver and receive letters. So this kind of correspondence spread awareness of amanuenses as a common feature of the life of scholars and authors in their own time and also to historians. These letters, too, on paper, were saved and often collected in the early modern period, especially when one of the correspondents was well known at the time, but not always. And thirdly, then, most surprising to me, has been seeing how often amanuenses appeared in print, fleetingly, of course, and usually without being named. And I bundle their kinds of appearances as the servant function, as a complement to Foucault's author function. It took different forms, but basically worked by adducing the misdeeds of the servant, the amanuensis, to explain problems in the text that the reader might notice. I argue that by relieving the author of responsibility for mistakes, the ploy helped to allay the new acute level of anxiety brought on by publishing on the vast new scale that printing involved. Of course, publication existed before print, as Daniel Hobbins has emphasized in a book of that title, Publication Before Print, and authors from the ancient and medieval period also manifested anxieties about the potential for an unfavorable reception of their work. But printing greatly raised the stakes of publication by producing and distributing a book on a much wider scale. From the beginning, the business model of printing involved making more copies than you necessarily knew you could sell in order to not only break even on your expenses, which were all made up front before a single copy was available for sale, and hoping to sell more than the bare minimum to break even in order to make a profit. If you suddenly decided you had a bestseller on your hand and you didn't have enough copies to sell, it was a complete loss because to make a second printing involved starting all over again. With all the investment in paper and labor and time. So the printer needs to sell copies. The author, however, has a slightly different motive. The author hopes for a favorable reception. The two goals are not perfectly aligned. So for a scholarly author, I would say printing was attractive. Of course, this is how you diffuse your reputation across space and time, but also frightening in that to a Europe-wide book trade centered on fairs in Frankfurt and Leipzig, and with Latin as a learned lingua franca, the learned book could reach readers in faraway places and could stay available for generations into the future. So the risk of an unfavorable reception far beyond the control of the author was heightened. And the context of confessional conflict in the 16th century, which is basically underlying all of my examples, further raised the stakes of a negative reception, since there were constant tensions and shifting distributions of power, not only between the main rival confessions, but also within each of them, factions within Catholic and many Protestant churches as they vied for power. So authors who miscalculated the impact of their book could face devastating consequences. Hence the virtues of the servant function to relieve the author of some of this anxiety and responsibility. In its elaborate version, a thieving servant is responsible for the author rushing into print. If it hadn't been for the servant selling or threatening to sell an unauthorized manuscript to a printer, the author would have had more time to perfect it. Given the circumstances, the author asks the kind reader to excuse the failings that resulted from a hasty publication. This is, of course, a variant of the classic modesty trope of the reluctant author saying that he was pushed to publish at the insistence of friends, students, family, or patron. It's also something that could actually happen. In the essays of Montaigne, which, of course, we see here the Bordeaux copy, which is the last copy printed in his lifetime, which he annotated himself, and from which the third edition of 1595, published by Marie de Gournay, his so-called adoptive daughter, was printed. Mostly, Montaigne works by adding things to each successive edition of the essays, but in this case, he removed something in the Bordeaux copy by crossing out this passage. Now, because it seems very close to our own, I intended to take this passage from its author, having once taken the trouble to say very amply what I knew about the comparison of our armor with Roman armor. This is a section on armor. But this scrap of my notes, having been stolen from me by several others, with several others, by a man in my service, I will not deprive him of the profit he hopes to make from it. Also, it would be very hard for me to chew over the same meat twice. So Montaigne is saying, too bad, the passage is gone, comparing arms of the French and the Parthians, but I'm not going to rewrite it. And of course, the man in his service, as far as we know, didn't publish it or make a profit from it. So I, you know, am inclined to take this fairly much at face value as an episode that occurred in some form. At other occasions, I might be more skeptical. Erasmus, for example, complained in a To the Reader in 1515 that his epigrams had been published without his authorization. Quote, some servant, I suspect, filched them and sold them to the printers. But since the printer involved, Josbad, was one Erasmus continued to work with, this does not strike me as entirely convincing. So here it's perhaps more of a ploy. And theft was also something that an anxious principal could worry about happening, even in the absence of any misdeed. Robert Boyle, whom we encountered last time, telling you about the distemper in his eyes and the poor quality scribe who'd no doubt made mistakes, here is complaining that he remembers an occasion where he had lost a manuscript that he was much concerned for, and he made a fuss about it in order that the plagiary, the thieving servant, would conclude himself unable to make the manuscript pass as his own. And in effect, the book wasn't a while after privately brought back, so I found it laid in a byplace where I had before as fruitlessly as carefully sought it. So what's going on here? Boyle is claiming that someone stole the manuscript, a servant stole the manuscript, and then thought better of it and brought it back to the right place so he found it later. Doesn't it seem a whole lot more plausible that Boyle just lost track of the manuscript, didn't look closely enough in what clearly was a very messy workspace? That is, of course, the interpretation of Michael Hunter, who studies this among other paratexts. So here we're seeing that Boyle is worried about the untrustworthy helper so much that he sees it happening, even probably when it didn't. And, you know, yes. A more basic form of this servant function is some version of please excuse the errors of my amanuenses. And these errors could take various forms. Errors in judgment are at issue for Conrad Gessner when he's writing his gigantic Bibliotheca Universalis in 1545 with about 1,500 words, which is an alphabetized bibliography of authors. And in his preface, he explains, I won't deny that the summaries or chapters of some books are explicated more verbosely than I would like, but this occurred mainly in the first letter of the alphabet, when I relied on the work of amanuenses. In the rest, I would not want to be briefer. So clearly he's feeling defensive about how it's too big. And the work was indeed the object of an abridgment 10 years later. Gessner is actually echoing the apology of a medieval polygraph, Vincent of Beauvais, who in his 13th century Speculum Maius explained in his prologue, "Some things in this work, especially on the deeds of martyrs and confessors, were not as fully abbreviated as I would have liked, because given my commitment to too many other studies, I abbreviated things not in my own hand, but mostly through the hands of notarii, insofar as I could. Nonetheless, it is no less true that an excessively abbreviated narration is less pleasing to the reader or the listener." So here he's apologizing for being too long, and interestingly, the French translator in the early 14th century of this passage instead hangs on to the last sentence and apologizes for it being too short. So the point, the beauty of this servant function is that it is versatile. It can be used against whichever kind of criticism you most fear and wish to forestall. Whether the text is too long or too short, it's the fault of the amanuenses. Most commonly, amanuenses are blamed for scribal errors. This move occurs in printed errata lists. So this is a new kind of paratext, come on with printing, happens at the back of the book typically, a list of errors to please correct in your copy in an address to the reader. So here we have Erasmus's translation of Gaza's Greek grammar, ending with a list of errata, but prefaced with a little blurb, Froben to the reader. This is in Latin. Remember, we know that basically Erasmus wrote, or someone in his entourage wrote these. While it was in press, we gave the book to reread to a learned man from our friends who noticed several errors of the amanuensis who copied the book. And here they are. So that's very clear on who did that. Interestingly, Erasmus is more willing to take the blame when writing in his own voice in a polemical text, responding here to the accusations of the conservative Catholic Noel Beda, where he introduced the errata this way. He said, "We have listed here the errors due to the printers or the amanuenses or finally to a slip of my own pen, so that one who wishes to could easily amend their codex." Erasmus used his own voice also in one of his last works, the Ecclesiastes, a giant sermon, a preaching manual of 1535, where a short list of errata is accompanied by a to the reader with a complex assessment of responsibility. Many authors like to blame their errors on the work of the printers, but I frankly admit that almost all the errors in this work must be attributed either to my amanuensis or to myself. It is true I was present during the printing, but because of my poor health, I was unable to make a final revision, especially since the need to correct certain pages often coincided with the hours that had to be devoted to sleep or to the care of my poor body. There was, however, no need for my help, since that task was vigilantly carried out by Sigismund Galenius, a man of great learning and taste. But when I had the leisure to read over some of the printed pages, I discovered several places that had slipped through my revision. There's not a huge number of these if you take into consideration the great length of the work, very few if you discount trivial errors. I thought I should add a note here to this effect. So we have a to the reader with an errata list designed to deflect blame away from the printer. Quite unusually, it includes explicit thanks to the corrector at the printers, Sigismund Galenius, whom Erasmus also thanked in print in 1529, remembered in his will, and designated as one of the team he would like to prepare the Opera Omnia, which actually happened after his death. But then, of course, he is listing some errors that Galenius had not caught. And, of course, he's adducing his poor health. We've seen this. In this case, perhaps not a ploy. He died a few months later. As far as I can tell, the servant function is an innovation of the 16th century. Anxiety around publication certainly predated printing, but not this kind of attempt to alleviate it. And so I'm going to offer a few comparisons with the ancient case. I see signs of anxiety about publication, even before printing, in the act of making a text public, sharing it with others so that you lose control of it. In the Ars Poetica, famously, Horace warns one who might want to write verses without knowing how to, "If ever you do write anything, let it enter the ears of some crucial Micius and your father's and my own, and then put your parchment in the closet and keep it back till the ninth year. What you have not published, you can destroy. The word once sent forth can never come back." This is probably not music to a publisher's ear. Wait 9 years before publishing things. Another example I would suggest is the story that Virgil on his deathbed and in instructions left to his executors called for the destruction of the Aeneid, an achievement impatiently awaited by Augustus, among others, and which Virgil had spent 11 years composing. This story was much repeated in antiquity and surfaces again among the humanists. Why is that? Various interpretations have been advanced that take the claim seriously. Virgil was a perfectionist, couldn't bear the prospect of others controlling its edition, or that he was ashamed of the work for slavishness toward Augustus, not very likely, or on the contrary, for stealthily attacking him for it. I propose instead that the story, which is so here in the Stanza della Segnatura, in a little grisaille, floated by Virgil himself and or others in his circle, was designed to shield the author from criticism because he did not mean to publish the text in the form in which we have it. It gave Virgil plausible deniability for any failings that others might find there. Surely Virgil would have remedied them if only he had had the time to do so. So thank goodness Augustus sets in to prevent this destruction. It's hard to show absence of a pattern like blaming the amanuensis, but some examples from Cicero's correspondence suggest that he avoided doing so even when he might have, as analyzed here by Randolph Richards. So first, he's got an example of a complaint from a correspondent about the tone of a previous letter, and Cicero replies, "What letter of mine it is you describe as unduly choleric, I cannot make out. But if, as you write, the letter was badly expressed, you may be sure I never wrote it." So he's denying responsibility for it, but he's not pinning the blame on anybody else. Cicero disowns the whole letter instead. And then, more tellingly, I'd say, in this controversy that erupted in 49 BCE near the end of his term as provincial governor, Cicero was accused of altering account books retroactively. And we can infer from Cicero's reply to a correspondent that the latter had suggested that Cicero's secretary had altered the accounts rather than himself. And Cicero is indignant in response. "Your proposal that the secretary would have done this robs me of the fruit of my liberality, of my activity, even of a moderate amount of good sense, and of my diligence, because you suppose that in regard to so important a duty, my secretary made any entry he chose without even going through the form of reading it over to me." So Cicero is also reiterating his complete trust in his secretary, Scriba Maeus, and he doesn't name him, but we know who it is, Tyro. And of course, there were likely multiple reasons why Cicero declined to take the convenient excuse being offered to him. His confidence in Tyro's honesty, perhaps a concern for Tyro's reputation. But Richards suggests as well, and from a few other instances, that blaming the secretary was not, in fact, considered a respectable excuse in this context, though it might have lessened the blame cast on Cicero to some extent. So mentioning errors of amanuenses was not only a defensive ploy, it could also be the opportunity to boast of one's contributions in correcting them. Indeed, one of the premises of the Humus Project was that a long succession of past amanuenses had introduced errors in the transmission of old texts, whether classical or Christians, which could be corrected with proper skills and attention. So here we have a lovely depiction along the lines of what we saw with Catherine of Siena, the divine message, the conduit of John the Evangelist, who with a lovely scroll is dictating to his scribe, Prochoros, who is using a set of wax tablets or a codex form. And then we envision this whole, it scribes all the way down, you know, instead of turtles, it scribes down to the present. These are the amanuenses, anonymous, accumulated over centuries, whom the humanist's job is to clean up after. So in any long textual tradition, successive layers of scribes go very far down. The best place for boasting about correcting errors was the title page, which was, of course, invented by printers to lure buyers. And many title pages claim they offer a more correct and copious text or index, but only a few explicitly mention errors of the amanuenses. So here's one, Ericus Olai, who had died more than a century earlier when his History of Swedes and Goths was published in 1615 by the humanist Johannes Messenius, who highlights his contributions on the title page, corrected of the almost innumerable errors of the amanuenses. He organized it in 6 books, he provided an index, and published it for the first time. And then interestingly, in a later edition, all that is dropped. In 2 other cases, I hypothesize that the claim is made in order to push a new edition when a previous one already existed. So we have Cujas's commentary on the left on the late antique jurist Julius Paulus, first published posthumously in 1596. And the following edition of 1604, 8 years later, boasts that this most famous and useful work has been purged of the errors which insinuated themselves through the carelessness of amanuenses, as in, buy this edition, even if you already own the previous one. In the case of a treatise against astrological conjectures by the Jesuit Alessandro de Angelis, 2 editions appeared in the same year in different cities. I suspect the first edition on the left appeared in Lyon, certainly it's the most widely distributed now, while the second from Rome added the bonus claim of having been purged by the author of many errors of the amanuenses and illustrated with new examples. So these 2 patterns of blaming amanuenses for errors to protect the reputation of an author and of boasting about a new and improved version of the text elicited a most unusual piece of paratext, the only one of its kind I've found so far. It appears in a collection of 10 medieval English history manuscripts published in 1651-52 by Roger Twisden and John Selden, who has a 57-page-long introduction. It's a very large book. The text is followed by an amanuensis to the reader. This is actually a piece of paratext that precedes further paratext, so after it comes various lessons, and then glossary, and index, and so forth. So in the amanuensis to the reader, we hear from the amanuensis, Ralph Jennings, who explains that he took care in consulting the original manuscripts. He compared the manuscript with the manuscripts in Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, otherwise known as the Parker Library. And he proofread from the manuscript, except in the case of the Parker Library manuscript, which he couldn't access. I mean, they wouldn't let it out of the Parker Library, and he clearly was not able to proofread there. So the Bodleian actually has four manuscripts that were scribed by Jennings around the same time, the 1650s. Here's one of them, and you can see here the CC annotation is because this manuscript also was collated with a copy at Corpus Christi, Cambridge, CCC nowadays. And here you can see in English, it actually says compared with and so forth. So here Jennings is scribing and someone else is doing the comparing. Other times Jennings did the comparing. Here we see that Jennings has corrected a manuscript that was made by someone else, Edward Earberry. And here we see, this was on display on Tuesday, a receipt that Jennings has been paid 40 shillings for writing the history of the monks of Glastonbury, that is transcribing and collating other manuscript copies of this treatise, including one belonging to Sir Thomas Cotton and one belonging to Richard Tichborne. So Jennings clearly held a high reputation in his time, which actually endured until the following century, because the antiquarian John Ross in 1716 praises Jennings by name for copying the manuscript most skillfully and for his admirable care in the industry in the 10 Decem Scriptoris of Twisden and Selden. His name no doubt obscures others who helped, right? This was the named amanuensis. Perhaps there were other helpers. But it certainly drew unusual attention to the complex scholarly work that could be assigned to an amanuensis. After these many examples of paratexts which mentions amanuenses, we've seen authorial prefaces deploying the servant function defensively, errata lists pinning more or less blame on amanuenses, and title pages that boast of purging the texts of errors of earlier amanuenses. I'd like to close with an unusual case of an amanuensis who's named in print in the text authored by his principal. And this example will nicely set up the theme of the next lecture about how do we want to think about the work of amanuenses. Is it mere mechanical copying, or because it's performed by people, it's actually not? So this is the story of Pontus de Thiard, whose castle is still visible in Bissy-sur-Flay in Burgundy. And it concerns, so Pontus de Thiard was publishing in 1591 a book entitled On the Correct Imposition of Names, and it's basically a natural history book talking about terms for things, and he has a whole section on stones, in particular, stones that form in animals. These would be gallstones in our thought, and here we have from the Pharmaceutical Museum in Basel, the bezoar stone, which was thought to have wonderful properties of many kinds. They don't have on display a stone which is going to be discussed in this passage, which is a partridge stone, a perdicite, because of perdix, as Latin for partridge, which was a stone that formed in the body of a partridge and that you would encounter if you were eating said partridge. So we're going to look at a long passage in this work where the two marginal notes signal what the important bits are, new concerning the perdicite, this partridge stone, and Philippus Robertus. I had retired to my castle of La Salle near the end of the summer 1591 with Philippe Robert, learned jurist and great connoisseur of Greek and Latin letters, who spent most of his day on his editions of Demosthenes and Isaias, while I devoted myself to the study of Philo. And indeed we know, although it's since lost, of an edition of Isaias by Philippe Robert. When, one day, as evening was falling, Comon, my calligraphus a manu, came to see us, exulting. "I have, master," he said, looking at me, "something that you could please add to your little book on the right imposition of names, which you have given me to transcribe. Here is a perdicite, which I pulled out with my own fingers from the gullet of a partridge, which was served to us from the remains of your meal." And contemplating this kind of crystal, of delicate transparency, which was of a size and shape that made it difficult to think that it could have been swallowed by such a small bird as a partridge, so if it wasn't swallowed, it was formed internally, or that it could have formed naturally in it, I declared with surprise and doubt, "Come on, what game are you playing with us?" And he, blushing a bit, excused himself. "With all respect, I assure you that what I declared is the truth. If it isn't, master, henceforth do not believe me on any matter, divine or human. I split the gullet of that bird, came across this stone, and removed it myself from the neck of the bird, which I then ate. Your chaplain, who's here in person, this valet, and all the other domestics who saw this with their own eyes, I can bring them before you if you'd like." "I agreed, smiling. Give us this stone," I said. "I believe you. You've convinced me." And I turned to Philippe Robert. "I am reminded of this passage in which Aelian reports that partridges in the region of Antioch even eat stones. But we are far from Antioch." After a little discussion on this stone between myself and the very learned Robert, I enclosed it in my collection of precious stones and kept it carefully with me. Nonetheless, when some time later I was writing these lines, it seemed to me that its red tint had completely dissipated, although its crystalline transparency remained. But from this digression, we must return to the road. So, we can't confirm this incident. Of course, we have no other evidence of it having happened. And yet, it seems unlikely to be completely fictitious. We've got the two learned men who are framing it. They start off basically doing parallel play, apparently in the same room, a study, a library. They're exercising otium, you know, during the summer months, a respite from their worldly duties as officials of various kinds. And in bursts the calligraphus, who presumably had waited till after dinner. He's not, I don't know, or if he can barge in any time. I'm not clear on that. Unfortunately, I don't know anything about him. Even having a name doesn't really help that much. I think we get a very detailed description, almost like the virtual witnessing that people like Peter Deere and Stephen Shapin talk about for the Royal Society. You know, we get the setting of the scene, we get the invocation of witnesses who could be brought to confirm, we get the description of the stone. But of course, the principal is not entirely buying it necessarily, right? He's got some skepticism here. He nonetheless takes possession of the stone, calms the amanuensis down, of course, I believe you, and then leaves to the reader to weigh all this. You know, the stone is decayed, and of course, you know, we're not near Antioch, and we don't know, it seems unlikely. So Thiers clearly is the principal here, the knowledge maker. But from our perspective, Caumont also contributed to the content of the text, while carrying out a task which Thiers likely considered merely mechanical, copying over a book manuscript in progress. Maybe it was a clean copy, maybe it was just a copy for the press. In fact, not all copying was considered beneath a learned man's station. Early modern scholars sometimes engaged in scribing themselves, especially when copying making that first copy from a rare manuscript original, and thereby creating a copy that would have special significance in the text's accurate transmission. So Poggio Bracciolini, for example, of Lucretius, his own copy having been lost, but he gave it to others, so we have copies by other people. And in a case described by Henry Woodhausen, brought to my attention by Arnold Hunt, the English antiquarian Sir Simon Dews reported taking extraordinary content at copying in his own hand the Fleta, a medieval legal text, from the exemplar owned by Robert Cotton, which may have been the only complete copy and was certainly very rare. But Dews's enthusiasm for the task evaporated immediately when he learned that one Ralph Starkey had already made copies of the text and sold them. At that point, the scribing was no longer an act of scholarly transmission, but mere reproduction. So Dews stopped his efforts, had the rest of the manuscript copied out by, quote, an able librarian whom he hired. But for copying out his recently composed manuscript, whether for further editing or for use by the printer, Thiers' decision to delegate the work to a secretary with good handwriting was, of course, unproblematic. He also expected Caumont to make a reliable copy without modifications, a kind of mechanical operation. But Caumont was not a machine. He understood the Latin text he was copying. He connected to his own experience, and indeed copying the passage on animal stones likely primed him to find one in his meal. And he explicitly asked for his find to be included in the learned treatise. When artisans and other, quote, mechanicals were mentioned in learned works of natural philosophy, for their testimony or expert opinion, they were rarely named. But here Thiers named him. And Caumont would have been well aware of this outcome if, as is quite possible, he wrote out the passage, either under dictation or making a clean copy later on. Presumably, Caumont was pleased at being named, although we can only speculate about the broader dynamics of this relationship with Thiers. For Thiers, was this a favor happily rendered to a well-liked member of the household, or was it a case of humoring a pesky servant? The underlying emotions are really inscrutable from such little evidence at this cultural remove. My takeaway, though, is that scribing can only appear as mechanical from the perspective of the person commissioning the work. The people doing the work were intellectually engaged in it, drew on their judgment, skills, and experience, even if their personal contribution is rarely as visible centuries later as it was, thanks to print, in the case of Caumont's contribution to Thiers' learned treatise. Daniel Wakelin has argued of medieval scribes that they had to pay close attention to their process and reflect on the errors that they themselves or others were likely to commit in order to avoid or to correct those errors. So making a copy of a text is always also a fully intellectual process, as well as an act of physical and mental discipline. So next time, we'll dig into the Erasmus Corpus on that theme of mechanical versus intellectual. Thank you.